She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And we are so glad that you're joining us today. Again, I'm going to say, is it really March? Almost the middle of March. The show today is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, which they are the largest privately owned waste management company in Southern Arizona. And please note that they sell organic compost, probably the best on the market. If you're in Tucson, make a note of that and be sure to check them out at thefairfaxcompanies.com. This is what I call an action-packed, content-rich show today, so let's get on with it. Calling in from one of my favorite places on the planet, and anybody who's a part of Mrs. Green's World knows that, Miraval, which is all about living life in balance, and today we are pleased to have Dr. Jim Nicolai, who's the medical director, I've got to take a deep breath, Jim, of the Andrew Weil MD Integrative Wellness Center, which means all about living life in balance and being healthy. So thanks for being here with us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. It is a mouthful, isn't it?
It is a mouthful. And I mean, if I read about you, it's like that's going to be half the show. But you really are. It's a total early adopter thing that's going on out there at Miraval. You're a board certified family practitioner. You're a graduate of the Integrative Medicine Fellowship at the U of A in Tucson, working directly under Dr. Andrew Weil. So there's a lot of substance to what you bring to the table, and you believe in whole person medicine. So why don't we talk about that, what that really means? It's not a medical treatment, take a pill.
Yeah, exactly. I think whole person just means that we're more than physical. And oftentimes, especially in our conventional medical training, a lot of what we're trained on is finding out what's wrong with us, looking at the physical parameters that might find disease or something that's not necessarily working right within our body. If we can do that conventionally and stabilize it or manage it, that's great. But what happens when your dis-ease or imbalance is not in the physical world? You feel something is wrong, you feel out of balance or out of sync, but everything checks out normally on the tests or the physical exams. That's when, as a conventional doctor, I don't have much to offer, but that's when integrative medicine shines. And I think that's the appropriate time for us to consider you as beyond just your physical body, but as emotional, mental, relational, spiritual, even energetic, and target treatments in those areas so that you can get back into balance.
And, you know, you've coined a phrase, and it's a very poignant conversation for me today, because I know my biggest challenge in terms of my health is regular exercise. Everything else Yep. seems to come before it. But you talk about making a realistic goal, which I did. I started all over again today. So I did my really hard walk and then my 20-minute, it's called the 30-day shred. So I got them both in. But yep. What you talk about making health goals, and I love this phrase about called the right TV, which is not for television. That's like not TV.
Yep. Well, I think it's important for things to just be realistic in order for you to have a goal. You know, what we oftentimes do is we don't dream anymore, or we sort of wish we'd like to be in some spot, but we don't necessarily create a plan to get there.
Yes.
And part of what I would do in anything, you know, whenever we're successful, we know exactly what we want and we create a plan to get there. The same thing goes with your health. It's got to be specific. It's got to be something that you can measure. It's got to be realistic and approachable. You may want to stretch yourself a little bit. And then you want to give yourself what I call TV, which is just transformational vocabulary, which just basically says, if I want to lose 20 pounds in 12 weeks, if I call it just that, it has a certain feel to it. But if I say, I want to lose 20 pounds in 12 weeks, but and enjoy the journey and the adventure along the way, then it has a whole different dynamic for it. And I look forward to it as opposed to thinking about it as work. Just with a couple of different words or phrases, we can trick ourselves into getting there. We just have to find the right way and the right pattern to get there.
It's just so weird because today was a perfect day for that. Instead of saying, oh my God, I have to exercise, I got up, I put my walking shoes on, and I said, I can't wait to get outside and hear the birds and see the bunnies. And just the mindset, I couldn't wait to get out. So there, you're talking about that kind of switch, looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing that we talk about is I love this acronym. I'm all about acronyms, I guess, called NET, which just stands for No Extra Time. In a sense, if I can create a health regimen or ritual that's within your life as opposed to outside of it, then you begin to kind of think about how to do it as opposed to yet again another thing that I got to get done. Because sometimes that can be overwhelming in its own right. So when I go on my walk, I've created literally a walking meditation that I do when I walk my dog every morning. I know I got to walk my dog. I know my dog wants me to walk him or her.
We'll remind you if you're not.
And will remind me on a regular basis that right. is absolutely happening today. And for 5 or 25 minutes, I go on a walking meditation as opposed to thinking about my to-do list or all the things that have happened that I'm reacting to or responding to. I get into a really nice meditative sort of zone-like space as I'm walking the dog. It's something I got to do already, and I kill a couple of, or I make a couple of things done. I'm not going to make a reference to hunting here. in the same breath. That's when things begin to get doable and they become fun again. And I think that's what we're talking about.
Well, the fun things that there are, I mean, I make a joke about I Heart Miraval, and I wish I could come there once a week. But you have some new private session opportunities, and I love the names of them. So maybe you could talk about each one of them kind of quickly. Spontaneous happiness, spontaneous healing, and finding the zone.
Yeah, so the first two that you said really dovetail along the work that I do with Dr. Andrew Weil. Both of those titles are dovetailed to the books that he's talked about, which really talks about an idea that we can achieve a movement towards health and healing by doing things, small things ourselves, as opposed to think it's going to magically come or I got to do something above and beyond to get there. That's spontaneous healing. Spontaneous happiness is all about how can I do quick tools to get my emotional sea level in balance. It doesn't imply that I'm not going to feel bad. It doesn't imply that life isn't going to create situations around me that aren't going to be difficult or challenging. But might I be content or fulfilled within that time or scenario? And that's what that one's talking about. And then finding the zone is just really all about discovering and consciously going towards that state physically when we just feel like things are clicking. Things are moving in the right direction. Things are, wow, just we're having a good day. And oftentimes those times or moments or states are fleeting and we don't know how we got there. There are some conscious steps and tools that you can do to get you more of a chance to have that happening in your life. And that's what we teach people to do. And we teach them to do it with biofeedback, which is some technology that shows them how their body is looking at in that state.
And I will bet you, this sounds really corny, but I'll bet you people absolutely love it. Love that part, the biofeedback.
You know, it's once you get validation that you can do it and that you can do it in a prolonged and maintained and sustained kind of fashion, then it's like, whoa, this is cool. And again, that's when health becomes fun. Oftentimes, we perceive health or trying to be healthy as doing things that are tedious or challenging or involve discipline, and as a result, they are not part of a day that we would really want to create a regular routine in. And when it can be fun and adventurous, and you know, when recycling gets to be cool, then you do it more.
Right.
And when it's a game, it's just not necessarily drudgery, and as a result, it's an adventure, and everybody wants to be in an adventure. So I think that's where you're right. I think people begin to go, wow, this is neat, and I can access it. Once that happens, you begin to try to do it more.
And that whole thing about kind of baby steps, manageable chunks, and making it happy. And we have about 1 minute left. We're actually a little bit over, but I knew talking to you that that would happen. When you, and I just have to ask this again, and I may have asked you this before. For all of the people that you see at Miraval and in your experience, your vast experience, what's the biggest challenge that people face? Is it what they eat? Is it exercise? Or is it taking care of their soul? Because I do believe it's mind, body, spirit. And what usually goes first?
You know, I guess what I would probably tell you is I think more, I see people who are dealing with the stress of life. And I think that manifests in so many different ways. That's where whole person response comes in, because at some point, the stress of the life around people can hit them physically. At some point, it can help. It can hit them relationally. At some point, it can hit them in that their dreams go away and now they're just existing. Half of the battle is spending time with individuals to just figure out what their response is and how stress has hit them. Miraval is all about giving tools for numbers or for different people to fit their different style, to be able to recognize their body when it's under stress, and to be able to do some simple things to try to manage it in a more proactive way.
Right, and take some action. Yes.
It takes some action, absolutely.
Yes. Well, you are wonderful to spend time with us, and I can't wait to come out there again and see you. And
it's
thanks
great to
for
be
being
again.
A part of our of Mrs. Green's World. This is Dr. Jim Nicolai, who's the medical director of the Andrew Weil MD Integrative Wellness Center at Life and Balance, also known as Miraval. Thanks a lot, Jim.
You got it.
Say hi to everybody out there.
I will do that.
Okay. Up next, we are going to get Ivy Manning on the line. She is an author of two books. She's going to be today live at the Tucson Festival of Books, one of the largest festival of books in the world. And she wrote two books, has written two books, The Farm to Table Cookbooks, The Art of Eating Locally, that's one book with a colon, and The Adaptable Feast. And she'll be presenting at 4:00 at the Student Union in the Saturita Room. And the best way for you, everybody listening today, and I hope there are lots of you, to find about a Tucson Festival of Books is just go to the website, TucsonFestivalOfBooks.com. And it's, if you're listening right now, it's not too late. I'm moderating a panel at 2:30 and one at 4:00. And the other guest that we're going to have on the show is just a hoot. His name is Drew Aquilina, and he's an internationally award-winning cartoonist and author of the book Green Pieces Books and Green Pieces Cartoons. So we are so excited about having two people on today. Ivy, are you there?
I am. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for being a part of the show, and I can't wait to be a moderator for the panel at the Tucson Festival of Books. So let's go right into it and make every second of your time count and talk about I love the talking points that you sent me, because it's a great story of growing up in the Midwest and your grandfather grew vegetables. So tell a little bit about that story. You had a working mom, had convenience food, but just why don't you take it from there?
Yeah, I'm in the Ruth Reichel camp wherein I learned to cook, because otherwise I would have starved. My grandmother was a great cook, so therefore my mother never learned and never cared for it. So
that sounds like my children would say about me. I just have to tell you, they'll be laughing when I share this. So go ahead.
She went back to school to get a degree, and I figured out how to cook. My first Thanksgiving, I was 13. So, yeah, I've been interested in food all along. But honestly, even before that, as a little kid, I used to make clay food for my dollhouse.
So you had it in the DNA. And what you shared with me cracked me up, because I think Bon Appetit, one of the biggest challenges of Bon Appetit is finding the ingredients that they recommend you use. And you went to the store and couldn't find garlic. Is that really...
I'm from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and in the winter it's pretty bleak. Or it was. It's lots better now, but yeah, very, very tough to find fresh garlic. They had jarred maybe, but not the fresh clove. So reading Bon Appetit magazine at about 13, 14 years old, a lot of it was pretty perplexing at first, but it's gotten a lot better since then.
I guess so, since you've written two cookbooks. I mean, two really unbelievable books. So tell, I think people love to hear the stories. You were a foreign exchange student, and was that through a Rotary program or just an exchange, youth exchange program? And then you went, this cracked me up too, that you were in the house, this was your destiny, a retired pastry chef.
Yes, I went AFS, American Field Service.
Okay.
And I was a foreign exchange student for a summer in northern Greece, of all places. I think I'm the only person that could say they've lived in Greece and never saw the Acropolis. I never saw Athens. I hit the jackpot. I lived with a retired pastry chef. He owned his own pastry shop and had just retired. And, and any typical Greek housewife of that generation. Of course, she was going to the market early in the morning and cooking huge lunches. That was the big meal of the day. So I just hung out in the kitchen really the whole time.
Well, I want to go there because I sometimes dart around a little bit, but this is the best way to place to put it. When you talk about the food supply and this woman went to the market every day, what could our world look like if we eat a lot more fresh food, but we go once a week to the farmer's market and can stock up on it? But do you think there's enough supply of organic, pesticide-free, non-GMO foods available if there was a huge, gigantic shift today and people started doing this more and sought out fresh vegetables that are real food that have energy and nutrition in them? What's your crystal ball look like?
I think, it depends on the region you're in. I'm lucky enough to live in Portland, Oregon, and we have farmers markets, I think it's 6 days a week now, if not seven, and you just have to seek them out.
Right.
And the model isn't that absurd, because that's just how, I just got back from a trip to Florence, Italy, and that's how they live. They live that way now. I mean, there's a special store for your produce, and then there's a special store for your cheese, and you go to a different place for your meat, and all of that's, they insist on GMO-free, not always organic, but, that's still a way of life in a lot of the world. It can certainly happen. I think it's just demand. There has to be, people have to be willing to spend enough money on their food to make it worthwhile of, local farmers to truck the stuff in. And I think that paradigm is shifting, but I don't necessarily think it's happening fast enough, because for every farmer's market that's open, there's a McDonald's around the corner, if you know what I mean.
I know, so I do. And I think
we have to stay feisty about this.
that's a good word. And very active. And for mainstream people like me, when you think about the affordability factor, to me, it's all about looking at your budget or your spending practices as a whole. And I'm not a coffee drinker, but lots of my friends are. So if you have five lattes a week, you can certainly afford to go get your fresh vegetables at the farmer's market if you choose to give that up. Because they are, when things are in season at our farmer's markets, they're so affordable. I mean, it's because there are lots of them. But talk about how food is, vegetables are raised today, certainly not for flavor, more for shipping and how they pack. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the shape, they've changed the shape of foods to be square to fit more of them in the packaging.
Square watermelons, yeah.
So seriously.
You talk about cost, and I mean, there is the cost of the pocketbook, but then you also look at health costs of eating highly processed foods, and you get diabetes and heart disease and hypertension and all of these other things that are much, much more costly in the long run. You look at that, and then you look at the cost of, these mega farms that are doing, monocultures, and the cost of the soil, to the soil and to the environment when you're spraying them with pesticides and, heaping on the fertilizer and some of the other petroleum, it's all linked together. So I don't think you can say I'm paying, 20 cents more for this cabbage, for instance, than I would at the, at the huge mega grocery store. Well, look at the costs compounded in other ways. You can't just look at the price tag.
You really can't. It's such a trade-off. And people, I always wish people would connect the cost of health care to what we're doing as a country. It's kind of scary, because you can see the effects, and people don't necessarily connect it to what they're eating. And we are going to have to take a short break because that's what we do on talk radio. And when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about GMOs a little bit and about why the wave of everybody being gluten intolerant. So this is the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We're talking to Ivy Manning, author of two books, Farm to Table Cookbook, The Art of Eating Locally, and The Adaptable Feast. We'll be right back. Please stay here with us.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Did you know that the 2012 VW Beetle has been completely redesigned, that it has exciting new features, look, and performance, and that it is one of Oprah's best things for 2012? The best news is Chapman VW has them in stock. Check out the new Beetle at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan, or visit them at TucsonVW.com. Be sure to tell them that Mrs. Green sent you.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill, but I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Welcome back, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. There's so much to think about today that there, I think that's the first time I ever stumbled over that phrase. We heard earlier from Dr. Jim Nicolai, who's the medical director at Miraval. We are now interviewing Ivy Manning, who's written two books. She started cooking when she was 13, she says, said earlier on air, in order to survive. She is going to be presenting today at the Tucson Festival of Books at a panel, and I hope that you'll be able to come hear her. She's presenting at 4 o'clock at the Student Union at the Santa Rita Room. So if you're listening to this, you can hurry up and get in the car and come on down. So let's go, Ivy. We're going to talk a little bit about why is everybody now gluten intolerant? What's your read on that? Because you have to have some feel for it, given the feel that you have for food.
I do. It's actually a rather personal issue. I've actually kind of isolated that I'm definitely leaning towards the gluten intolerant thing. Actually, I've known for quite a while, but I'm finally admitting it. And I just finished my third book. I just finished my manuscript for my third book, which is about crackers. And I figured out that I should probably lay off the wheat right around when I signed the contract for the third book, which was great because really what I did was I discovered how to make a lot of crackers gluten-free. So I have a whole separate chapter because a lot of people are realizing they might not be celiac. That's actually a disease.
Really, really hard. Yes. Yes.
Right. You can be really seriously ill or just intolerant where they feel bloated or they just don't feel good. And I've read some really interesting articles, and there have been a couple studies that it might be the wheat that the highly genetically modified wheat that we in America eat, it's higher in gluten, it's higher in certain proteins than, say, wheat abroad. I just came back from Italy, and I did have pizza, and I had pasta, and I was okay. So, you know, the verdict's still out on that stuff, but people are becoming more aware of what they eat, so I think it's just natural that they're going to start to find things that, you know, maybe they're eating too much of. I think Americans in general, if you think about it, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, there's wheat. It's in every dish, and anybody's going to start to say, hey, you know, wait a minute.
I know, and with so many of the different, the new, I call them, you know, the new diagnoses for things, it has to be either the air we breathe, the toxins in our home, or what we're putting in our body. And frequently I find a lot of research to support we're eating a lot of food that is absolutely and positively almost devoid of any nutrition.
It would be akin to being in a room with, you know, clashing cymbals. It's okay for a minute in a symphony, but if you had to sit in a room and that's all you heard, your body, your ears would get sensitive to it. And I think our bodies are just becoming overfluxed with all of the contaminants in the environment and the things, you know, the processed things we put in our body. And our bodies are starting to speak up. I think it's only natural.
Well, okay, and back to you and your journey. I think it's very interesting how you started at 13, you traveled, everything was serendipitous as far as I can see from your history. But what made you move to the author stage? I mean, to have written 3 books, that's prolific. That's great. So what made you decide? You spent a lot of time in kitchens, working in restaurants. What made you decide, I've got to write this down, I've got to start sharing it with people?
Well, I was an English major. I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I was an English major and an Italian major, and I went to culinary school right after college because I just couldn't get the food bug out of my mind, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else. So those two wove together. I mean, I cooked and I taught a great deal, so before that, and then I started doing restaurant reviews because I just find it an offense when a place is really not good or is advertising, you know, to be sustainable and isn't, or whatever it was. I liked to review restaurants, and then I got into food writing through that. So, and you know, going to farmers markets, I would hear over and over again people saying, "Oh, isn't that pretty, that Romesco or whatever? Well, what is it? What do you do with it? Oh, I'm not going to buy it. I don't know what that is. Or I'm not sure that that's the best one or whatever. You know, I don't know how to pick one out." So, It just occurred to me that even just in my own region, people needed help. If they were going to add more vegetables to their plate, they needed help in finding ways to make them. Because if you overboil it or burn it or undercook it or get one that isn't ripe, you know, you're probably never going to try that vegetable again. But if you make it and it's the best thing you ever had, you're going to keep going back to it. So.
And it's just amazing to think about in my lifespan how things have changed. My mother was that great cook. She did shop locally. She did make things that kids, even in my friends, never even heard of. Like, we had Brussels sprouts on a regular basis. My mom was all about vegetables and fresh cooking, and her daughter skipped the generation one, so my kids loved grandma's cooking. So that's the Farm to Table cookbook. And can you talk a little bit about the Adaptable Feast and what that is about?
I married a vegetarian. And everybody, including my maid of honor at our wedding at the toast, pointed out that nobody thought it would work. And I got sick and tired of cooking him a separate meal and began to kind of resent it, frankly. And so I said, well, you know, there's got to be an easier way. And I started figuring out ways to cook one meal that fed everybody. So whether you have one vegan in the group, or you've got a vegetarian, or your teenager comes home one day and says she's never eating, dairy and meat ever again after she saw that, you know, animals were treated or whatever.
Yes.
It is.
Yep.
These are adaptable recipes. You cook it all the way to one point, and then there's sort of a fork in the road, and there's the vegan portion or vegetarian portion, and then everybody else has a little bit of meat. That's not to say that, you know, these aren't three-point landing meals. It's more meat as a condiment. Meat isn't, you know, the big picture on the plate. It's just part of it. But so, yeah, they're recipes for people that are going through that, because I feel their pain every night at dinner. I have to figure out how to do this. For instance, I'll make a pad thai, and I figured out a vegetarian fish sauce. It's really quite nice. And I'll make the whole thing vegetarian, or put tofu, you know, just in his portion, and then I add some shrimp to the sauté pan at the end for me, and then toss that in. Okay, so it's stuff like that and soups and things like that that are a little bit trickier.
And it's happening more and more and more in families because you're talking about my family. My one daughter doesn't eat any meat whatsoever except occasionally chicken. And another daughter really likes a lot of fresh vegetables. And, of course, then there's their mother. And thank God their father is a really great cook. And it made me laugh because he starts almost everything he cooks with a little bit of olive oil, onion, and garlic. And how can you go wrong? Okay, what I think is kind of, it's going to be quite a challenge as a moderator of the panel that you're going to be presenting on. I get 30 seconds to introduce each author. I mean, the training we got, it's like strict, strict, strict. So I'm glad that you're getting to be on the show so people can hear a lot more about you. I want to ask you, how hard is it once you write the book? Is it all about going on tour and promoting it? What's been your journey on now what will be your third book in terms of getting people to find it and buy it?
I do a lot of public speaking. Fortunately, I have, I was a teacher at a Whole Foods. I ran a cooking school for 3 years. So I'm pretty well, and I teach at Bob's Red Mill here in Oregon. So I'm pretty well versed in getting people excited about food. So I go out to farmers markets and I talk to people and show them the book and kind of try to spread the word about eating seasonally and also eating in a mixed diet family, and soon crackers. So I travel a fair amount, especially regionally, and I have my website. My blog is currently on hiatus because I was working on my third book.
Yeah, that's the never-ending challenge of blogging. I relate to that one. So tell everybody that your website, I remind people that they can contact me to get in touch with you, but what is your website?
My website's ivymanning.com.
And they can find your books there?
And you can email me directly through that. Yeah, and you can find my books there and then clips to articles. I write for Cooking Light magazine, Bon Appetit, Fine Cooking, Sunset. And I have a column in the local Oregonian newspaper with features. And those are always up on my website.
And you were interviewed by Martha Stewart. I found that in some of the research, so that's pretty cool. She is, certainly a big, high name. What did she interview you about?
Actually, about mixed diet eating during the holidays. They have me on her radio show kind of frequently, usually around the holidays, because people are at a wit's end. If they have a vegan coming to dinner, they sort of panic.
That's really a great topic, and I will let Kelly know that that's a time to have you back on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network.
So that would be an honor.
I look forward to meeting you very, very much so and to introducing you. And if people just tuned in, we've been having a great conversation with Ivy Manning, author of two published cookbooks, soon to be another cookbook, the Farm to Table Cookbook, The Art of Eating Locally, and The Adaptable Feast, and Crackers, which I am very excited about. And you will be at the Student Union at 4:00 today at the Santa Rita Room. And I hope people listen and listen to the rest of the show because we have Drew Aquilina coming up. He's another wonderful award-winning cartoonist. So, Ivy, thank you for being with us, and I will see you in a couple of hours.
Thank you, Mrs. Green.
Okay, take care. Okay, everybody, we're going to get Drew Aquilina on the show, and I hope I'm saying his name right. He is another character. He's an internationally award-winning cartoonist. He's author of Green Pieces books and Green Pieces cartoons. He will be presenting numerous times throughout the festival, but the one not to miss is Drew's panel with Mrs. Green at 2:30 on Go Green Issues, and that's at Kofler Room 218. And I know that I have quite a bit of a national audience for the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, which I love. So I just encourage you to visit the Tucson Festival of Books website and just Google things. I mean, it's an event that if you are a person that loves to read a lot of books, then we'd love to have you come to Tucson. There are over 100,000 people that visit, unbelievable authors. So we have a lot of really good things going on in Tucson. Love to put the spotlight there. And I'm excited to be interviewing two of the authors that will be on my panels. I'm thrilled that I have two panels that I'm going to do. So do we have you, Drew?
Yes.
We do. Thank you so much for being a part of Mrs. Green's World today. And you are an internationally award-winning cartoonist. And I can tell a really wonderful person that has lots of nice things to say about the planet. And let's get started with When we talked earlier today, you talked about how you started and how you came to be a cartoonist, and I'd love you to share that with our listeners.
Well, sure. When I was growing up as a child, I did a lot of playing outside. We didn't have a lot of distractions of video games or the internet, and being outside and being around nature so much, I just fell in love with it. I used to at night watch the Disney movies where they put voices into the animals' characters and they would talk, and I thought that was fascinating. And as I got to college and I taught myself how to draw, and I did a cartoon strip for a daily paper when I got out of college, I thought it would be great to do a cartoon strip about nature from nature's point of view. And it was originally called Environmental Pieces because it was supposed to be a nature documentary that was actually funny and about different facets of nature and interesting facts. And then at the time, the word green was just coming into vogue, and so I thought the title would be better as Green Pieces rather than Environmental Pieces because it sounded a little too scientific. So.
And it sounds fun. Green Pieces sounds really fun. And
yeah, it is.
You told me that you wanted your cartoons to look different from what you were seeing cartoonists doing then. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, I really wanted the backgrounds to be naturalistic. The cartoons at the time, they kind of still are. They're getting refined down to very simple backgrounds and very simple gestures. And I really thought it was an opportunity to, again, harken back to Disney and all the detail they used and put that back into the cartoon strip. And the other thing I wanted to do was have a strip that everybody could relate to, because everybody knows what a squirrel is. It doesn't matter who you are.
That's true. It's not a it's not a political statement.
Right, exactly.
Exactly right, right.
So the goal was to have something that everybody would have in common, and that's a real benefit for a cartoon strip. And then after that, all you have to do is make people laugh, which is the fun part of the cartoon strip.
And it's a way to get people involved. I love to use learning through laughter. I think it's a huge thing, and to not make it political and not feel like you're making fun of people or nagging them or whatever. And I think your comics absolutely capture that. They really are a lot of fun. So how did it go from the cartoons into a Green Pieces book?
Well, I got married, and my wife found all my cartoon strips in a box underneath the bed.
I love it.
She said, yeah, and she pulled it out, and she said, you know, you should put these in a book. And that was about 2 years ago, and Lisa and I have put together this book, and as you mentioned earlier, we've been winning contests all over the country. We've been winning international contests as well. We just won the Comic of the Year in London. Was our last award.
So did you get to go, did you get to go there?
No, the due to the flight and the timing, we couldn't. But we had a friend of ours receive the award for us, so it was a lot of fun to watch that happen over there. But it's just like you said, it's an important thing to do is to teach people about nature through laughter rather than fear and intimidation. And I think Greenpeace is success is because it's making people laugh.
And what do you think about, like, I have kids, but they're grown, and I have grandchildren, and my experience has been if you do anything where you are fully present with kids and get them away from any e-device, any electronic connection, they're all over it. They want to go outside. They want to do things. So is that part of your message, is getting kids involved?
Oh, it certainly is. I mean, I'm afraid that kids see the outdoors as something that happens when you leave a building and the light and the temperature changes drastically. And so I'm trying to get the kids to get outside and to relate to nature a little bit more. And just like you said, if you get kids on a wetland cleanup or a river cleanup, it doesn't take them more than 5 minutes to really start wondering what all that stuff is underneath that rock or that log or just being fascinated with every part of nature. It's an amazing transformation that when you see it happen, it's like an aha moment. And the key is giving them the opportunity to be outside and get outside. So one of my goals is to get, with the cartoon, is to get people to appreciate nature a little bit more, and then to get outside a little bit more and participate in some local activities.
And there are so many of those that we have going on all over the place. I can't imagine a community that doesn't have it. We are going to go to a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more with Drew Aquilina, award-winning, internationally award-winning cartoonist and author of Greenpeace's books. Please stay here with me.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
This is Mrs. Green with some great news about the Honda 2012 CR-V. It was named one of the top 10 cars with the best resale value by Kelley Blue Book, and it was recognized as the country's greenest automaker by the Union of Concerned Scientists for the fifth time in a row. If you're looking for a car with great mileage for its class and a bold new look, please visit Chapman Honda at 4600 East 22nd Street. You'll get the best ownership experience possible.
What if you had simple and easy solutions to live, work, and play green? Green Living Magazine, the premier green lifestyle magazine, brings you the latest in organic cooking, gardening, health and wellness, chef and celebrity interviews, as well as easy solutions to clean up your everyday life. Visit greenlivingaz.com for the latest in green news. Buy your subscription and view our network videos. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and again at greenlivingaz.com.
Do you dare to share? In 2009, the University of Arizona started its car sharing program. Today, students, faculty, and staff have access to a shared fleet of cars that includes 7 hybrids and even the zero emissions Nissan Leaf. Not only does car sharing give the campus community wheels, but it takes all those extra cars off the road too. Now that greens things up, doesn't it? The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And we're certainly giving you a lot to think about today. Action-packed show. I said earlier in the broadcast, content-rich, action-packed. We interviewed, I interviewed Dr. Jim Nicolai, the medical director at the Andrew Weil Integrative Wellness Center from Miraval, which is where my heart lives a lot. And two authors on the show today that are live at the Festival of Books. Drew is on the line right now, and he has numerous presentations, including one that's going to be covered on C-SPAN, not to make you nervous, Drew. But earlier we interviewed Ivy Manning, author of Farm-to-Table Cookbooks, The Art of Eating Locally, and The Adaptable Feast, and found out she is author of a third cookbook that's coming out called Crackers. She'll be 4 o'clock at the Student Union in the Satterita Room, and Drew Aquilina will be with me at 2:30 at a Green Issues panel, Go Green, at the Koffler in room 218. So, Drew, thanks for being a part of the show today, and I'm really excited about you being part of the panel. I do want to say, too, people that listen to my show on a regular basis crack up because I always forget to say things like, please listen to Mrs. Green's World every Saturday live at 12 right here at MrsGreensWorld.com. Follow me on Facebook and Twitter because that will keep you up to the minute on all great green things on a daily basis. And if you happen to miss the show because you're busy doing something else, like you're at the Festival of Books, please remember that all of my podcasts live on my website, MrsGreensWorld.com. We're getting lots of traffic there, and I love it. So don't forget to connect with Mrs. Green's World in ways that work for you. So, Drew, okay. We don't have a lot of time left. It always flies.
Sure.
You are. You went to. I'm interested in the part about getting kids active because I think that it's really sad that we have a world where it's a whole
it's like a slippery slope, because not only are they not connecting with nature, it means they're inside and it means they're not exercising. And you talked about when you were a kid. When I was a kid, here was the drill. Come home from school, do my homework, and then be out until it got dark.
And we, exactly.
I mean, that was the deal. TV, you got to be kidding. I could not care less. Not so much anymore. So what is your the message of your cartoons and your book helping people to realize, and how are you getting that message out?
Well, I'm hoping that the cartoon becomes a window to the natural world, that the kids might not see that often, and they might come across it on the internet. But the kids are looking at this cartoon and reading the cartoon and sort of relating to the characters, Iggy the claustrophobic turtle or Cabby the scientific bullfrog.
Right. It's
actually been working out for me, because one person who was reading the cartoon from Florida, which the internet is wonderful about people getting to read the cartoon, him and his son saw a turtle that was struggling along a curb on a road. And the father told me that his kid made him turn around, do a U-turn, get out of the car, and help the turtle up over the curb.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said it was because the kid has been reading and getting to know Iggy. He thought he was helping Iggy's brother. And it just made me feel great, and it made me feel like the cartoon is actually having an impact. And getting the kids outside is so important, because, like you said earlier, once they get out there, it's just amazing the change. And the internet is a blessing and a curse, but the blessing part is you can have a handheld phone and you can actually figure out what all that stuff is outside using the internet. So it can help the kids, but it is a tool. And I think getting outside is the first step, and that's the goal of the cartoon.
And I think having, our kids were interested, very interested in nature, because every vacation we ever took was always, it wasn't to an amusement park or some structured activity. We went somewhere to the mountains or the ocean, and it was tide pools or hikes, and it was fun looking for different kinds of animals. But today, in urban living, there's still, to me, a great opportunity through things like community gardens and chicken coops. I mean, there are community chicken coops. I think my neighbors want us to start a community chicken coop. And it does, eggs don't come from Safeway. They come from chickens. So right. that's another possibility for people to get involved. And I want to ask you, how have you seen things change since when you started doing this? I know your bio said 1987, but you really got started in the early 90s. What kind of changes have you seen, both positive changes and negative changes, in terms of the awareness of the environmental issues at the local level? Because you love to stress that, and to me, I love that part of your message. Think globally, act locally.
Right. And well, it's just been a lot of changes. When I started, the environment was all about protecting it. And it was kind of like the goal was to prevent pollution and to preserve it. And then as time went on, the politics and the world climate change got into the equation. And next thing you know, people are trying to save forests all over the world and countries. And for me, I think the success of the 90s of the environmental movement was that it was local. Rather than trying to worry about something that's happening a half a world away, there's so many opportunities to clean up a local wetland or to clean up a local preserve that I think getting back, to the term, getting back to the grassroots of the environmental movement is getting out there locally and cleaning up their own backyard. If everybody took the time to do that, everybody's obviously yard will be clean and the whole world will be a better place for it.
I could not agree with you more, obviously, because I am from Mrs. Green's world. What do you do to help promote your message, and how do people decide to pick up your cartoon and run it? It's daily in a lot of newspapers, correct?
It's in a couple newspapers, but it's on the internet right now. All the cartoons these days are moving to the internet, and it's on...
Everything's moving to the internet. You're so right. Early adopter, everything's moving to the internet, especially if you want to get kids.
Right, exactly. Yes. And it's on greenpeacescartoons.com, and it's on Go Comics, which is Universal Press's website. So it's in two different places. But the cartoon, again, I do local stories or stories with the animals locally at the pond, and then I do stories about things that happen all over the world. But the goal is to get people, again, interested in nature and laugh a little and learn a lot. So.
And that makes people excited. I mean, to me, if you, like I said, if you can have it be fun and all about learning, I think it's the big blessing. And what about in your area? You live in the Phoenix metropolitan area, yes?
Yes, I do.
Because to me, even an activity that can get kids interested in nature, as wacky as it may sound, is taking your kids to the farmer's market. There's a proliferation of farmer's markets here in southern Arizona. There certainly are around the country. I mean, I do a lot of research. So they're growing, and our farmers markets, it's like a festival every Sunday, the one that we go to, and it's kids and it's families and it's grandmas and grandpas, and people have their reusable bags. So what is it up like up there up north?
Oh, the same thing. There's farmers markets that pop up. There's ones that it seems like when I drive down the road on a Sunday or a Saturday, I see another one pop up, and it's just great to see all the local farmers bringing their products to a market like that. So there's a lot of people transitioning, like you said, with the grocery bags to those reusable. There are events that are being held up here. There's cleanup events. There's a lot of stuff happening. It's the beauty of beauty of the internet is that it's all on there. If you just type in, you know, environmental cleanup or something like that on the internet, all this stuff just comes to your screen, and there's so many activities to belong to and to work with local groups with. So it's really great.
And you're going to be presenting at my panel, but what are the other things you're going to be doing at the Festival of Books? You're like big man on campus. When I saw the publication that came out, it's like, oh man, I'm so lucky that I got Drew.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. No, there's three other panels at the conference, and I'm going on Friday and on Monday to local schools as well. If you get to the festival, which is one of the best festivals around because we've been to several of them, and as far as organizing and as far as parking and ease of getting in and out, it's one of the better festivals in the country.
So totally.
It's in the top
totally.
Four. And I'm at the doing a solo presentation at the Education Building in room 349. And obviously, like you said, we have a booth in the children's section at booth 424. And we also are going to be on a panel for cartoons, Laugh a Little, Laugh a Lot, and that's Saturday at 4.
I know, and I can't go to that one because I'm moderating another panel, but I would love to go to that one. It's like, how can I be two places at once? That one looked like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, I know, and I'm looking forward to that. And then there's New Possibilities with Cartoons and Books for Kids. And that's a panel that's on Sunday at 4 o'clock to 5, and it's in the Education Building, room 353. So with that, and then going to the schools, the local schools, it's going to be fun. I do a presentation where I teach kids how to cartoon and how to draw, and then a little bit about what makes things funny. And it's a great presentation, and I also work with the local children's hospital here in Phoenix and working with the kids that are in the hospital there and teaching them to draw. So it's kind of like a very fun thing to do is to teach kids how to create and draw cartoons. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do.
And you have a day job, so it's like, yeah, you want to ask somebody to get something done, give it to a busy person, and you are very busy. So there's that. I want to turn a little bit seriously for a minute because this is something that I get asked a lot, and it's two parts. I get asked a lot. One is, what do you think, with your background and your commitment to and awareness of the environment, what do you think the biggest challenge or some of the biggest challenges we face both as local communities and as one planet in this year, 2012?
I guess the biggest challenge I see is getting people to understand the world around them better. There's so many distractions. There's so much that can affect your day that happens in the environment around you that people just aren't aware of. And I think the biggest challenge is with the internet and the smartphones is that there's so much information, there's so much distraction. I think the biggest challenge is getting people to, again, understand that, you know, when you leave your house and right outside is a whole entire world that really has a direct effect on your own. And once people can get, a handle on that and understand that better, I think the environment will be a better place for it. So to me, the challenge is getting people to get back to nature. I think that's going to be the biggest goal for me with the cartoon.
I think it's just probably one of the most laudable goals there are, because I think if people do connect, they're going to really be far less likely to mindlessly abuse, as I put it, or ignore some of the challenges that we face. They'll care about turning the water off, and they'll care about turning their lights off, and care about eating healthy food and supporting locally owned businesses, not just environmental businesses, but any local business helps your community be healthier. And then the other part to the question is, it's I've stayed very much out of the recent hoopla about Rush Limbaugh and the whole conversation that's been so politicized about contraception, because to me, one of the things that all the candidates should be talking about are environmental issues, and not in a political polarized way, but with a common goal, because you said earlier in the show, the one thing that everybody has in common is the environment. So how do you think your message helps to, you keep it out of politics, you apoliticize environmental issues in a fun, informative way. Is that purposeful on your part?
It is, because once you get into the politics of a story or a cause, people start taking sides. The environmental movement has been politicized. It's been brought into, once the people in Washington, D.C. start making decisions about it, you know it's been politicized. And trying to give a voice to nature from nature's point of view and look at the world from nature's point of view, I think is the goal, because once, like I said, once you get one side or the other, people start taking sides. And the goal of Greenpeace is to look at both sides. And both my characters, Iggy, who's the environmentalist, and then you have Cabby, who's the scientist, and having that debate happen, but again, in an apolitical way, I think is a good way to handle it. And again, keeping out of the fray, I don't think it's a very good way to teach people about nature using fear and intimidation. I think using humor and going about teaching people about the environment in a funny way will go a lot further for people, like you said, relating to nature. And once they have an investment in it, or they it's personalized for them, they're going to want to take care of it on their own. They don't need someone to say, you need to recycle or you need to turn off your lights. So, again, it's a difficult task to do, to stay the middle of the road. But I think the environment was around a long time before politics. So I think it shouldn't be too hard.
And I just like to be, I write a lot on my Facebook page. People say that I'm a dreamer. And of course, I love that line. I know I'm not the only one. You're definitely another dreamer. And what's the best way for people to contact you and for people to get engaged in the conversation with you and your availability to speak? I'd love to know what schools you're speaking at in Tucson also, because I think that's a great community service on your part. And whoever's going to be on the downside of that or the receiving end is going to be lucky.
Yeah, and I don't have the names of the schools handy right now, but there are four of them. But people have been following us on Facebook, and that's a great way to do it, because we post cartoons there as well. They can reach us through greenpeacescartoons.com. We have a website there that people can contact me as well. But Facebook has been really great for that.
It's such
I'm
a
not
wonderful
on Twitter
tool.
Yet.
Okay, you will
yeah,
be. I'll be tweeting away about you.
Oh, wonderful. And so it's, but I do go and speak to schools, and I've been working with Cub Scouts, and I've been working with Girl Scouts as well, and doing that presentation there.
Love it.
I
just love it. Well, we've got about 30 seconds, and I cannot wait to meet you. Thank God for your wife telling you to find that book, the carton under your bed. Next week, Betty Stamper from Solar One Stop, a national model for making solar installation easy. Please plan to be here with me. Make it a great green week, and come on down to the Tucson Festival of Books, Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Thanks for being here.